One of the many things I love about Australia is our egalitarian ethos. We're a nation that doesn't have private areas on the beaches and likes using the word mate. We rarely stand up when the Prime Minister enters the room and prefer to pay a decent wage rather than having people rely on tips. Since the 1800s, when European migrants alighting from boats said they felt they'd entered a workers' paradise, the spirit of Australian egalitarianism has burned bright. Unfortunately, when there's a bright light shining in your eyes, it can be hard to see anything else. And sometimes I fear that we think that egalitarianism is merely about battlers and billionaires sharing the showers at Bondi Beach. An equality of manners is a lovely thing, but as many a homeless person has observed, you can't actually eat politeness. Now, how much equality is there in Australia? One way of answering the question is to imagine we divided the population into five groups of about 5 million people each and allocated the Australian landmass to them in the same way in which wealth is distributed in Australia. For simplicity, let's start at the bottom and just draw lines of latitude across the nation that match the current distribution of wealth according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. The most affluent 5 million people get everything south of Carnarvon in Western Australia, Alice Springs in Northern Territory, and Rockhampton in Queensland. That's all of Tasmania, Victoria, South Australia, New South Wales, and the ACT. It's 3/5 of the Australian landmass, and just 5 million of them get to enjoy it. Everyone else has to move north of Rockhampton and Carnarvon. The next most affluent 5 million get half of what's left. If they're on the east coast, they can live in Townsville or further south, but so long as they don't go into Rockhampton. If they're on the west coast, they can be in Broome or further south, so long as they don't go into Carnarvon. This group, the second top, are the ones who get a proportionate share. They comprise 1/5 of the Australian population, and they get about 1/5 of the Australian landmass. Next, we're looking at the middle 1/5 of Australians. They get 1/10 of the nation, half their proportionate share. It's a little sliver from Port Douglas, north of Cairns, across to Kununurra in Western Australia. The second bottom group of Australians get virtually all of what remains. Like each of the other groups, there's 5 million of them, but they only get 1/20 of the Australian land area. It's a section that goes up to include Darwin and most of Cape York Peninsula. If you coloured in a map of Australia at this stage, you'd be forgiven for thinking that we're done. After all, we've allocated more than 99% of the landmass, and yet we still need to allocate a share of land to a group that makes up 5 million people. Their share starts north of Darwin. It includes a tiny pocket of Arnhem Land and the islands northwards, plus a small piece of Cape York Peninsula, where you can find the tip of the Australian mainland. I've actually stood at the tip of the tip. It's Indigenous land and it's beautiful country, but I'm not sure I'd want to share it with 5 million people. And still, that's what it's like to be in a group that gets less than 1/20 of your equal share. And that's Australian wealth inequality today. This is the first of three Just Ideas talks that I'll deliver over the coming months on inequality. They build on my 2013 book, Battlers and Billionaires, The Story of Inequality in Australia, and a dozen or so lectures I've given since on the politics of inequality, the role of innovation, market concentration and inequality, and policies to address rising inequality. My focus today will be on why we should care about the distribution of income. Because if I can't convince you to care about inequality, the rest doesn't matter much. I'm pleased to say the conversation about inequality at the political realm is crowded by excellent contributions from my parliamentary colleagues. In the past week alone, Bill Shorten, Tanya Plibersek, Chris Bowen, Mark Dreyfus, Jenny Macklin, Brendan O'Connor, Wayne Swan and Jim Chalmers are just among some of those who've touched an aspect to the inequality problem. My challenge today is not just to say something new, but to find a different angle from theirs. That's a good problem to have. So, why should we care about inequality? The starting point is to acknowledge what economics lecturers everywhere teach our first years. Economics is about maximising well-being, not money. The goal isn't to see how big we can make our GDP, but how happy we can make our people. Like all things, money has a diminishing marginal return. There are about 1 billion people in the world who live on less than a dollar a day. They spend most of their dollar keeping hunger at bay. And then there's about 1,800 citizens of the world who each have more than $1 billion. For them, more money means a larger yacht, a faster jet, or another holiday home. If you believe that moving a person from $1 a day to $2 a day brings more happiness than giving a billionaire another dollar, then you've accepted the idea of diminishing marginal utility of income. There's no better argument for caring about inequality. Putting numbers around this can be tricky, but an analysis by lateral economics finds that to get the same increase in life satisfaction, you either have to take someone on $15,000 and give them another $6,000, or take someone on $100,000 and give them another $100,000. Lateral economics estimates that the cost of inequality to national well-being is the equivalent of $54 billion a year, making it a bigger cost than mental illness, obesity, or long-term unemployment. Does that mean we should have perfect equality? I don't think so. In A Theory of Justice, philosopher John Rawls devises the thought experiment of an unborn baby, ignorant of his or her social position. That baby, Rawls argues, wouldn't want perfect equality. That way lies the famines of Mao's China, the drab sameness of communist East Germany, the lost potential of Castro's Cuba. Rawls argues that instead, our unborn baby would want as much inequality as would benefit those at the bottom. Now, I'm no Harvard philosopher, but my answer would be slightly different. As much inequality as would benefit those at the middle and the bottom. Either way, you could reasonably question whether it's necessary for 5 million Australians to have nearly two-thirds of the nation's wealth. The case for high inequality is strongest when those at the top are investing their additional resources back into productive enterprises. Think of instances in which entrepreneurs in Tel Aviv sell their firm and plough the money back into zippy startups. Or when Bill Gates and Warren Buffett devote much of their wealth into innovative strategies to reduce global poverty. Unfortunately, this isn't as large a share of spending by those at the top as we might imagine. Over the past few decades, a significant share of the spending by the super rich has gone into competing with their extremely affluent colleagues. The supply of harbourside mansions is basically fixed, so their price has skyrocketed. So is the price of a bottle of Grange, a spot at Sydney Grammar, or a Sydney Nolan painting. No surprise, the prices of all of those things have risen faster than inflation. They're what economists call positional goods. They're scarce, and they signal your spot in the pecking order. Economist Robert Frank gives the example of the quality of a suit that a worker wears to a job interview. If I think you'll wear a $200 suit, I feel comfortable doing the same. If I think you'll wear a $2,000 suit, I might pay up or risk looking too sloppy to get the job. In the world of luxury yachts, one expert observes that the client who 15 years ago would have been satisfied with a 40-metre yacht, which would then have been one of the largest yachts in the bay, is now surrounded by dozens of yachts of 60 to 70 metres, which plants the seeds that he really ought to upgrade. The world's largest yachts now include multiple swimming pools, submersibles, jet skis, concert halls and dance floors. Running costs alone can be in the millions of dollars per year. If you want a luxury car that will accelerate faster horizontally than it would if it were dropped off a cliff, then the new Porsche 911 Turbo will do 0 to 100 in 2.7 seconds, about 2 seconds faster than the same model 30 years ago. Much of the spending at the very top goes on things that start with private. The share of the Australian population with a private jet or a private helicopter is higher than ever before, prompting calls a few years ago for a floating helipad on Sydney Harbour. Norwegian Cruise Line has just announced that its newest ship will include an exclusive area known as the Haven, that's off limits to the rest of the passengers. Travellers in this area will board and disembark separately. They need never rub shoulders with the other passengers. But if they do so, they have a golden swipe card, which guarantees them the best seats in the ship's cinemas and restaurants. In some American airports, high-status travellers changing planes are driven between terminals in a luxury car. Disney World recently began offering after-hours entry to those who spend more to stay in an on-site hotel. Being private is the quintessential positional good. By definition, if everyone can come in, it's not private. If everyone gets a good service, it's not exclusive. When 19th century French railway operators decided not to put roofs on their third-class carriages, they were partly aiming to scare those who could afford to travel in a higher class. But making the poor uncomfortable isn't just inequitable, it's also inefficient. The same goes for pointless status races. Would the world really be that much worse if we took the standard for affluence back to 40-metre yachts and sports cars that could do 0 to 100 in, say, 5 seconds? While you think about those questions, let me remind you of how the bottom fifth of the distribution live today. Earlier this week, I joined my colleague Ross Hart, MP, at an early childhood centre in Ravenswood in northern Tasmania. For reasons best known to themselves, town planners in a bygone age decided that the best place to locate a low-income suburb would be to the east of Launceston, across swampy land and over a rise so it's out of sight of the rest of the city. Average household income in Ravenswood is $32,240. It's not per person, that's per household. The most recent estimate put the unemployment rate in Ravenswood at 16%. Family violence rates are high, and children often miss out on things other families take for granted, such as a car, school excursions, or parental social networks that provide a first job opening. It's not just in northern Tasmania that this is a challenge. 1 in 5 Australian families say they can't afford a week's holiday away from home once a year. 1 in 8 say they can't afford dental care. 1 in 20 say they can't afford Christmas presents for friends and family. Underemployment is at a record high, and wage growth is at a record low. 1 in 500 Australian adults are today behind bars, the highest incarceration rate in 115 years. Home ownership is at a 60-year low. If you spend all your time in inner suburbia, it's easy to miss the extent of deep disadvantage, since Australian poverty rates tend to rise the further you go from the city centre. There are massive inequities in every sphere of Australian life. For example, in health, the poorest Australians have 7 fewer teeth and live for 6 fewer years. In economic terms, this gap's been growing. Since 1980, the income share of the top 1% of Australians has nearly doubled. This represents around $500 billion that's been shifted from the bottom 99% to the top 1%. For years, researcher Paul Piff has been looking at how being at the top of the pecking order might change the way we behave. To high status people, recognise their success is due to good luck as well as hard work. Are they more inclined to be generous to those around them? Or are they more like Yertle the Turtle King, the Dr. Seuss character who demanded that his fellow turtles stand on top of one another so he could get a better view? In one of Paul Piff's studies, researchers slowly stepped onto a pedestrian crossing as a car approached and tested to see whether the driver would stop. They then looked at the relationship between the value of the car and the behaviour of the driver. Among those driving the cheapest cars, all of them stopped to let the pedestrian cross. But among those driving the highest status cars, nearly half drove straight through. In other work, Piff has shown that more affluent respondents are more likely to cheat on a test, lie in a negotiation, or endorse unethical behaviour at work. One theory, he suggests, is that narcissism is not evenly distributed across the population. Upper-class individuals in his studies are more likely to look at themselves in a mirror, display greater psychological entitlement, and show less compassion towards others. High-status respondents are more likely to be greedy and less likely to empathise with those who have very little. A similar result holds when Piff arbitrarily chooses to make some people rich and others poor. In one experiment, he asks two people to play a rigged Monopoly game. One starts with $2,000, gets $200 every time he or she passes go, and gets to roll two dice. The other starts with $1,000, gets $100 for passing go, and rolls one die. Given that the assignment is random, neither player should think that they're in any way more deserving. Yet, that's exactly what happens. In game after game, Piff and his team observe the favoured player teasing their unlucky opponent, taking up more personal space, and eating more food out of the snack bowl on the table. Asked after the game to debrief, the players who started with twice as much money and got to use twice as many dice often attribute their success to superior strategy, forgetting the game that was so rigged that it was nearly impossible for the other person to win. At this point, I should remind you this is just a game, and any resemblance to property developers, living or dead, is purely coincidental. Yet while Piff's studies show that putting someone in a high-status position tends to encourage narcissism, greed, and dangerous driving, he also shows that those traits are malleable. Just a small egalitarian prompt. His prompt is asking respondents to list three benefits of regarding others as equal. Cause those at the top to behave just like everyone else. Yet the risk is that rising inequality is also accompanied by fewer opportunities for people to empathise with those who are more vulnerable, to rub shoulders with those who have different life experiences than our own. In the United States, researchers have shown that income segregation has grown since 1970, with the share of children living in middle-class neighbourhoods falling from 65% to 40%. The top fifth of American families are increasingly different from the rest of society in terms of family structure, educational habits, and lifestyle. While the Australian data aren't quite as nuanced, there's good reason to think the same patterns hold here. In 2010, I wrote a book documenting the decline of civic life called Disconnected. And since then, statistics show Australians are less likely to be part of a social group, a trade union, or a political group. The share of the population that volunteers or plays sport has also fallen. There's fewer opportunities for the affluent to empathise with those who are less fortunate than themselves. Over recent years, we've seen a succession of excellent reports documenting the rise in inequality, including work from ACOS, the Evatt Foundation, the Chifley Report Centre's Inclusive Prosperity Commission. The National Reform Summit, sponsored by KPMG, The Australian and The Financial Review, noted the importance of achieving inclusive economic growth. Prior to the last election, my colleague Jenny Macklin drew much of Labor's thinking together in her landmark Growing Together report. For anyone with a progressive bone in their body, these reports make grim reading. Yet the risk is that understanding what's happened to Australian inequality in the past generation makes us fatalistic about the future. True, the trend over the past three or four decades has been that inequality has steadily risen, with only one or two exceptions. But if you take a longer view, you realise it doesn't have to be that way. In the 1910s to the 1960s, the income share of the top 1% approximately halved, from 13 to 7%. Wages became more equal too, with unskilled workers earning 71% as much as skilled workers at the time of Federation, but 91% of a skilled worker's wage in 1957. In other work, Mike Pottinger and I look at the ratio of the BHP CEO's pay to average worker earnings. We find that from the 1920s to the 1950s, wages grew faster on the factory floor than in the corner suite. There's nothing about inequality that says that it has to rise. We can point to other episodes too. When the pension was increased in 2009, it took the benchmark rate from just below the poverty line to above the poverty line. As a result, 1 million Australians were shifted out of poverty. Don't let anyone ever tell you that policy can't affect poverty and inequality. In this talk, I've focused on why we should care about excess inequality. If you accept that another dollar brings more happiness to a minimum wage worker than a millionaire, it isn't a big stretch to recognise that a society that only looks after its millionaires might be a less happy nation. If you're a child about to be randomly assigned into a household in Australia, would you really want a community in which the top fifth had two-thirds of the wealth, while the bottom fifth had less than 1/100th? And given what we know about how high-status people tend to behave towards others, do we want to encourage an environment in which the benefits of economic growth go overwhelmingly to a fortunate few? In making the case for why we should care about inequality, I've focused only on intrinsic arguments, the direct impacts of inequality. I've deliberately chosen not to focus on the instrumental arguments, those that say we should care about inequality because it affects some other important outcome. This is partly because, in my view, the instrumental arguments can be oversold. Yes, inequality probably reduces social mobility, but I'm less persuaded that it raises crime rates, for example. But the other thing that happens when progressives focus primarily on the instrumental arguments is we leave our best arrow in the quiver. If one person held all the wealth in Australia, we might still have the same economic output. We'd be a pretty miserable nation. In the same way, rising inequality risks lowering national well-being. To appreciate inequality is to recognise the difference between a democracy, which operates on the principle of one person, one vote, and the share market, which operates on the principle of $1, one vote. In a democracy, each person's happiness has an equal value, and one person's happiness shouldn't be based on another person's unhappiness. If you ask people what they pride about being Australian, you'll often get answers like mateship and the fair go, suggesting that many people view egalitarianism as an end, not just as a means to an end. Equality isn't a fashionable buzzword. It goes directly to our sense of national identity, of Lawler, Lawson and Lingiari. Australians are rightly proud of our egalitarian heritage, but to preserve it for our children, we need to act before the gap becomes too wide. Thanks very much.